Hello and welcome to Something's Off with Andrew Heaton. I'm your host, the Paperboy. And today, my friends, we're going to go down the wonk hole. We're going to talk about one of my least favorite things, yet favorite subjects, which is gerrymandering. If you're not familiar with gerrymandering, I invite you to listen to the program and get your blood pressure elevated through sheer unmitigated rage. But if you are familiar with gerrymandering, and I suspect you are, Eric Bame from Reason is going to join me, and I suspect we might be able to come up with some good solutions. And in fact, my hope is we can save the Republic itself from sheer partisanship and fool-doogery, which is definitely a thing, using robots. That is my hope for this, so stay tuned. But before we get into that, we do need to give a shout-out to today's sponsor. Something's Off with Andrew Heaton is brought to you by Uncle Milton's Crab Dip with Caffeine in It. There's nothing more energizing and wholesome than a hero's portion of caffeinated crab dip in the morning. But what do you do if you love the taste of crab dip, but you also don't drink caffeine for religious or health reasons? Or maybe you just like to eat it before you go to sleep, but you don't want to be awake till 3 a.m. Well, good news, friends, because the folks over at Uncle Milton's have you covered. Next time you're at the grocer's, do yourself a favor. Grab a jar of Uncle Milton's decaf crab dip. It's all of the bold, robust crab taste you've come to depend on in normal caffeinated crab dip, but without the caffeine. How does it maintain that taste? Maybe because Uncle Milton's decaf crab dip is 100% naturally decaffeinated using pure mountain spring water, which makes sense because Uncle Milton's only uses fair trade, ethically sourced mountain crabs from Colombia. One time, on a camping trip, we ran out of caffeinated crab dip, and I admit, I snuck in some decaf crab dip and just call it normal, and you know what? No one even knew the difference. Now, in all fairness, that was overshadowed by the fact that we had been lost for 2 days and it was the last of our rations, so we were all starting to seriously worry about starvation. You know, they say that you wander in circles when you're lost because one leg is slightly longer than the other, and that's not true. We do wander in circles, but not for any physiological reason. Maybe we do it because on some primordial level we understand that we're doomed. Maybe we just subconsciously mirror the vultures circling above us, or some part of us knows we're circling the drain and we act it out. Either way, by our fifth day in the wilderness, I was fairly confident that we'd passed the same dry creek bed at least twice, and boy, I sure could have used a solid helping of decaf crab dip right then. But there was only hunger and terror. Terror that I would die? No. Terror of what I might become. Because when imminent death is stalking you like a bear, which you also think is stalking you, you realize just how ephemeral all of the Norman Rockwell values you hold dear really are. When your stomach starts devouring itself in a hellish prelude of cannibalism that you might well inflict on your fellow Weeblo Scouts, it's when you realize just how close to the surface your animal instincts are, kept at bay by a thin sheen of civilization and its great bounty, such as Uncle Milton's decaf crab dip, which is a tangy and delicious addition to any breakfast or picnic. Yes, Uncle Milton's decaf crab dip is so delectable and robust, you won't even be able to spot the difference. But you can always spot murder in another man's eyes. You can sense it, a hint of cunning, of malice. And then you think, even if I don't eat Trevor, is he going to crush my head with a rock tonight and eat me? I mean, isn't it just preemptive self-defense to do it first? Viktor Frankl described people in horrible situations responding to their torturous surroundings like either saints or demons. He believed we always have the choice of how we respond to vile circumstances. Maybe that's true. But maybe that bandwidth of decision is a lot smaller than we like to think, because ultimately you're just choosing between the ethical equivalent of decaf crab dip and crab dip with caffeine in it, which, in the case of Uncle Milton's, is virtually imperceptible due to the fresh artisanal crab flavor you get in every bite. Yes, whenever I take a bite of Uncle Milton's decaf crab dip, I am instantly transported to pristine mountains and crystal clear rivers, devoid of man or civilization, ultimately of morality or humanity itself, just a will to survive and some abandoned tennis shoes barely 2 miles from the ranger station. 2 miles, that's how close. 2 miles. Uncle Milton's decaf crab dip. Just like Grandma used to make. Only with no caffeine. My guest today is Eric Boehm of Reason. Eric, thank you for joining me.
Thanks so much, Andrew. Good to be here.
Yeah. You've written about gerrymandering several times, and that is, I think, going to be a feature of this year's news cycle, and so I wanted to speak to you about it. Yesterday, I was reading The Atlantic. There was a story about how President Obama and Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger had sort of teamed up on this, or at least were syncopated in their efforts to fight gerrymandering. And that makes sense, given that there's multiple Supreme Court cases that I think are coming through this year. And also that the census is going to happen, which will affect all of these districts that are going to be redistricted. So I wanted to talk to you about that. Can you walk me through, what is gerrymandering?
Well, I mean, again, thanks for having me on, Andrew. I think before we talk about exactly what gerrymandering is, you have to cover that other sort of wonky word you mentioned, which is redistricting.
Okay.
This is a thing. It's in the Constitution. Every 10 years, we go through and we reapportion the congressional seats in every state and the state legislative seats as well. And that's a process that in most states is controlled by the state legislature. So that means that the state lawmakers in Virginia, for example, are redrawing the districts for the members of Congress, where the members of Congress will be elected from out of Virginia. And it's an intensely political process. It's a process that largely goes on behind closed doors. There are obviously a lot of political considerations that go into it. And so gerrymandering is sort of a term of art that is thrown around to describe a district that is drawn in such a way to achieve a particular political end. It can be to get a certain person elected. It can be to get a certain person out of the seat that they currently hold. On a statewide basis, gerrymandering is done to try and, tilt the advantage, the partisan advantage, one way or the other. So if you have, for example, in 2010, after the last census, the 2011 redistricting that happened, in a lot of what we think of as like the purple states in this country, states like Virginia or North Carolina or Wisconsin or Pennsylvania, Republicans did really well in the 2010 election. They dominated state houses for that process of redistricting. And so what you ended up with, surprise, surprise, is a lot of congressional maps that were tilted to favor Republicans and districts that were drawn to sort of boost Republican outcomes in Congress. And not surprisingly, Republicans have controlled the House in Congress ever since 2012.
I like that you use the term work of art, because it truly is. So I worked for the for a couple of members of the House of Representatives several years ago, and one of them effectively got districted out. Tim Holden, who I worked for in Pennsylvania, they sort of shifted the boundaries because they basically wanted to make that district no longer competitive. Tim had held on for a while because it was a conservative district, but he was a Blue Dog Democrat and he could kind of straddle that line. And so they went, oh, well, what if we cut out the unions? And we just removed that, and it got rid of them. And some of the, like, you would walk through Congress, and you'd go into various offices for completely legal purposes, and you would see these maps on the wall of the district, and they would be amazing. It would look like a cartoon dynamite explosion, where clearly the legislators in whatever respective state had exacto knifed out the specific cookie cutter shape to eliminate any pretense of an actual competitive election. I covered it. I have a book called Laughter's Better Than Communism. And one of the chapters is on gerrymandering as Warsaw tests, because they can be kind of stunning. Like this might have changed because the book was based on a 2013, so that they might have changed slightly. But in New York, like in the district that I most recently lived in, it looks like a lemur throwing a boomerang up in the air, because it's geographically two separate districts, but they technically, if you're touching water, it's still contiguous. So they can really cut up that district to make it not competitive. There was a district in Illinois for a while that looked to me like a rabbit on a skateboard. There's one in North Carolina, which I think is still there, that looks like a man being struck by lightning, where if you're looking at the map, you're like, that's not this doesn't make any sense. But it does make sense if the goal is to avoid any actual competitive election from occurring, which is what the two parties seem to want, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Maybe the best example of one of those crazy districts is the one in Pennsylvania that's been referred to multiple times as looking like a goofy kicking Donald Duck. That's an old district, because the courts there actually threw out all those districts last year. But
I think I know
you
that
mentioned
one, yeah.
Tim Holden. Yeah, without getting way down in the weeds, I mean, that's a great example. He was a conservative Democrat, so he's a middle-of-the-road kind of guy from a district that was, a purplish district. But then in 2011, when they went and redrew those districts, they completely reconfigured northeastern Pennsylvania into one district that is very tightly packed with lots of Democrats. It was a very, very deep blue district where he was not going to be able to win because a candidate could run to his left. And then more conservative districts. Yeah, so what you end up with, when all's said and done, what you end up with is, as you said, less competitive general elections because more congressional districts become single-party districts. Yeah. That means primaries become more important, and that gives an advantage to candidates that are on the far left and far right. And so I'm not saying that gerrymandering is entirely responsible for the sort of breaking apart of the two parties that we've seen and the sort of moving to the left and to the right, but it's certainly a factor in the kind of ongoing
I think it's a significant factor. And it's when you look at like Tim's district, the city of Reading in Pennsylvania, which I don't know what the population is. Let's say it's 800,000 people. I don't know. Reading was split into 80,000. So I'm only off by a factor of 10.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
But when you looked at Reading, the map, Reading, which is a city, like people would go, I am from Reading. They would say things like that. It was split into four different districts because Reading had a lot of Democrats in it, and there was a desire to keep it from actually being competitive. So you can cut those things out, which is why you get these interesting phenomenon where you could have more votes for Democrats or Republicans. I don't know if I'm going to pick on a particular party here, but you can kind of remove a threat, negate a threat. Like I think in Texas, if I'm not mistaken, Austin, which is a fairly bright blue dot, it is not Austin is a liberal progressive oasis in Texas, or bullet hole depending on your inclination. But it's I think been split rather than just the city of Austin. It's split into four different congressional districts, all of which are run by Republicans. So you're looking at a city that's overwhelmingly liberal that never actually has a congressman who's a Democrat, because the legislature's figured out how to negate that from actually happening.
Austin is a great example. Salt Lake City is a great example. There are only four congressional districts in Utah, but if you divided them in any sort of reasonable way, you would probably end up with one that was centered on Salt Lake City, which even as conservative as Utah is, would be at least in play for Democrats to win that seat if Salt Lake City had its own thing. So what did they do? They divided the state up four ways, and they also divided so that each one of those four districts has a little bit of Salt Lake City in it. This is one of two strategies that get used in gerrymandering. There are two names for them. There's packing and there's cracking. So what we're talking about here
sounds
in Austin.
Fun.
Absolutely. Sounds like a good old time.
Yeah.
In Austin or in Reading or in Salt Lake City, this is cracking, where you take a city. Generally, it's a city because you have high concentration of Democratic voters there. And what you can do is you can break that city up into a bunch of different districts, and you negate all those votes essentially by doing that.
That's cracking.
The other strategy is
okay. That's to balkanize the electorate, the geographical electorate.
Exactly.
Okay, cracking. Got it.
So that you end up with four districts in Austin, all of them are Republican, and there's really nobody from Austin whose vote is reflected in Congress with a representative.
Which
the other strategy is called
to go back to the partisan extremism. Sure. If you're looking at a district that has some semblance of balance between different political perspectives, you are more apt to have to make some sort of overture to people in your district that you may not be in the same party with. Whereas if I were in a district that was, say, 80% Democrat or 80% Libertarian, you know, all those districts. If I were in an 80% Libertarian district and you're running as a Libertarian, you're a lot less likely to reach out to the 20% of people that absolutely didn't vote for you. Whereas if you're in a reasonably competitive district, you might need to have a little bit of back and forth with the entirety of your constituency.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And I want to find where that 80% Libertarian district is. I don't know.
I could see maybe somewhere in New Hampshire. There might be because of the Free State Project. There could be, but I don't believe there's been any New Hampshire like super Libertarian Republicans or out and out Libertarians that have been elected.
Yeah.
Maybe.
The mythical 436th district in Congress is the 80% Libertarian one.
So we've got cracking. What is packing?
Packing is exactly the opposite of that. So packing is what was done, for example, in Northeast Pennsylvania in 2011, where you have a bunch of small-ish, very blue cities that aren't really all that close to each other. Scranton and Wilkes-Barre, for example, way up in the Northeast. You've got Allentown and Bethlehem a little bit south of that. You've got Reading even a little further to the west. And so what you do is you draw a very spindly, sinuous district that links those very dark blue areas into a single district and excludes all the redder areas, all the more conservative areas in between. So you pack all the Democratic voters into a single district. So that district is now, 80%, 85% Democrat. It's basically a single party district for all intents and purposes. And you get all those Democratic votes out of the surrounding areas, which you now end up, you can make three Republican districts out of the surrounding areas.
Well, that's great, because then you can have three Republican districts that are run by the primaries and the party leadership without really bothering with an actual vote. You've got it
as a
rubber stamp.
And on the Democrat side, you end up with the same thing. You end up with an intensely deep blue district that is going to be controlled by the primary voters, really, not by the general election. And so, in both ways, you kind of lose out the general electorate.
So, in North Carolina, the lightning bolt formation that I saw, that would probably be an example of packing, where it's like we're going to create this weird, lengthy shape in order to try and get every single Democrat in the area into this one. We're just going to – presumably it was a Republican legislature that did it and went, we're just going to give up on that district, but we're going to get out of this four or five very safe districts as a result.
Yeah, I think you're probably talking about the old North Carolina 12th. Now, in both these cases, both Pennsylvania and
North your stuff.
Carolina.
I was talking about the North Carolina 12th, and we're doing this on audio. Like, I don't know if you got notes in front of you, but I'm impressed. Yes, that was it.
I've got it pulled up right in front of me. Yeah, so both Pennsylvania and North Carolina, because of some court rulings, have had to redraw their districts within the last couple of years. So it's a little better now. I think there's actually a case going in front of the Supreme Court later this year that challenges the fact that North Carolinas are still unfairly gerrymandered, but they look a little better at least. You don't have those crazy shapes. That one, for example, there was one part of that district that was literally only a couple hundred yards wide. It was just about the width of a couple football fields, and it ran up an interstate through the center part of Carolina. So that district linked
it was an electoral umbilical cord that had no actual... No actual geographic connection to another thing, but managed
None
to link
whatsoever.
These two things. There used to be a district in Illinois. I think it's gone now, I hope. But there was a district in Illinois where if you, which I have to say, Illinois legislature also really fantastic at gerrymandering. They've been a historic heavyweight in that category. There was a district where if you were driving down the highway with both of your car doors, your passenger and driver's side car door open, you were in three different congressional districts simultaneously. Because they narrowed down that one strip of road to be part of the district for a while.
Yeah, and you mentioned about using roads or rivers or whatever. There's a great example in Maryland, too. I don't remember the district, so I can't be that impressive here. But there's a district in Maryland where it dives out into the Chesapeake Bay a bunch of times. So it comes on land and, grabs a couple towns and then pops out into the bay and goes down the bay and then comes back on the shore again and grabs another area.
Yeah, it's artful.
Like
this is where politicians really get to shine at being creative when it comes to gerrymandering. They're able to really – this is where the right brain – brainstorming, tinkering really comes out.
You say right brain. We should be fair to say this is both right and left do this. Both Republicans.
Oh yeah. Well,
actually,
when I said right brain, I meant more creative. But yes, that is worth doing. That is something that I wanted to ask you was a lot of the literature I read on this is focused on Republicans gerrymandering, which I think a lot of the latest wave of anti gerrymandering rhetoric happened after the Tea Party. So that makes sense. I honestly don't know. Is one party worse than the other?
No, I don't think that's true. I think the reason why so much of this is aimed at Republicans, and rightfully so. I mean, Republicans deserve the criticism they've gotten for what they did in places like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and North Carolina. But the reason is that Republicans controlled the process last time around, for the most part, because of that Tea Party wave in 2010 that just so happened to coincide with the census, that just so happened to coincide with the latest redistricting. Republicans got to do what they wanted by and large in a lot of these states because of the way the process works. In other states, though, you mentioned Illinois. That's a great example. There are awful districts in and around Chicago in particular that are drawn to protect incumbents. Maryland is another example where Democrats have redistricted that. Actually, there was a court ruling just 2 years ago in Maryland, too, that forced them to redraw some of the districts there because Democrats had unfairly gerrymandered, against Republicans. So both parties do this. They're both guilty of it. If Democrats control the process in 2020, in 2021, then I'm sure we will see this done just as badly on the other side.
I have very little faith in the goodwill and honest forthrightness of districting and redistricting as done by party leaders who usually, this is me psychoanalyzing, but I think people that are in party leadership tend to be primarily focused on beating the other team. Just win, beat the other team. And that, like, kind of everything else is secondary to that. Like, the economy, that's great. But really, I just want to beat the other team. And so I suspect that would probably happen. And I should note that both parties work hand in hand. And it's really beautiful to see this bipartisan consensus and trying to keep any, much of the time, keep any third parties from actually getting, you know, ballot access and things like that. There's all sorts of other mechanisms that are beyond the confines of gerrymandering where if you, say, want to have a third party candidate or an independent candidate, you've got to get like 100,000 signatures saying that they would vote for them. And while that's not being done with the Republican and Democratic Party. So the track record of both parties, in my opinion, is pretty low in terms of actually wanting a real competitive democracy. They want a duopoly, and they tend to want to really favor incumbents, which is another factor in this too, right? Like we're kind of focusing on red team versus blue team, but a lot of this is either protecting incumbents that are already in office or also potentially hurting them, if I'm not mistaken. Because if you're a congressman and I really don't like you, and I'm the I'm in the state legislature, I can kind of threaten you with redistricting, even within my party. If you get out of line too much, and we'll keep it Republican or Democrat, but we're going to organize it in such a way to get rid of you.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. It's a way for party leaders at the state level to really exercise a bit of control over their congressional delegations and the members of their congressional delegations. So, yeah, you're right. If somebody steps out of line or for whatever reason somebody falls out with the state party, well, you know, next time we draw the map, sorry, your house no longer resides in the district that you thought you were in.
Wonderful shape that like your fire hydrant said the congressional district, yep. But your house isn't, which does – that's happened a couple times where they'll just rearrange it. And then there's also a couple of weird things, like in Texas. I'm registered to vote in Austin because that's where I moved to when I moved down here. Both of the Republican and Democrat congressional candidates that I was eligible to vote for, neither of them live in the district because in Texas, just the way that the lines had been drawn, neither of them actually live in the area they're representing. But I think that is also a function of the constitutional remit, if I'm not mistaken, because the Constitution empowers state legislatures to redistrict. But beyond that, there's really no I don't think there's any real clarification on how to do it or what to do it. So you could have a lot of latitude on a state level, right?
No, that's exactly right. States are, the Constitution says states get to do this. In just about every state, the state legislature does it. There's, you know, and we can talk about some of this,
does the Constitution, yep. Does it specify that the state does it or the state legislature of the state does it? Like, because I know that there are independent committees in a lot of states. Is that within constitutional norm?
Yeah, so the Constitution specifies that it is the purview of the state legislatures to do this.
Okay.
There was actually a Supreme Court case a few years ago that clarified that the state legislature is allowed to delegate that responsibility to an independent commission or to another body if it so chooses. Because when a couple states got around to doing these, you know, sort of playing around with idea different ways to do redistricting, and this idea of a, you know, quote unquote independent commission is something that some states have tried. That was actually challenged, no surprise, by the political parties, and it went to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, yes, this is what the Constitution says, but we're going to understand it to mean that if the state legislature delegates that responsibility out, that they're within their right to do that. So there is a bit of leeway there.
Legit, because the legislature could just hand the legislature a paper and they can do an up or down vote on how to district it. Before I forget, going back to the packing, there is a court element in this as well, is there not? Because aren't there there minority majority districts or something like that where the courts in general have ruled they've tended to be fairly hands off with redistricting and gerrymandering, but they do come in when a particular ethnic group is being disenfranchised. Then the courts will step in. But a part of that is the result that they will basically necessitate that a district have a majority of minority people in it. Yeah?
That is something that is only in certain states as a result of the Voting Rights Act in 1965, I want to say it was. So there are certain southern states where that is required.
Okay.
That's something that where the Department of Justice will get involved sometimes and sort of mandate that sort of thing as a result of shockingly, gerrymandering was used to disenfranchise black voters, just like many
others. Amazed by this, really, okay.
Shockingly that would happen, right? But we do have some of those requirements on the books as well. The court, this is one of the areas where the Supreme Court has historically gotten involved, is on questions of whether districts were drawn specifically to disenfranchise, ethnic groups, primarily African Americans. But as you said, aside from that, the court has really steered clear. And on several occasions in the last two decades, the Supreme Court has been asked to weigh in on the question of partisan gerrymandering, not racial gerrymandering, right, but partisan gerrymandering. Is this district unfair to Democrats? Is this district unfair to Republicans? And almost entirely, the court has basically said, no, you know, we're not going to get involved in that. The most recent case just last year, where it was a case brought out of Wisconsin, and Chief Justice John Roberts wrote what ended up being a unanimous opinion where the court, all nine justices on the court, essentially said, no, you know, we're not going to place any limitations on partisan gerrymandering. And he essentially pointed back to a previous decision made in 2004 where the court said that there just isn't really any sort of objective standard to apply to this. And
right,
if there's
so
no sort of objective
one
workable
of the
standard,
I thought
can't
was
make a ruling.
That was one of the things that I thought was interesting is I thought, and maybe the upcoming Supreme Court cases will be this, but I had sort of assumed that it was going to be a proxy battle between originalists and living constitutionalists,
yep,
where the originalists are going to go, look, the Constitution clearly says this is a state's issue. This is not something the federal government can dictate to. And the living constitutionalists would go, it doesn't matter. This is so terrible and heinous that we should preempt that older interpretation of the Constitution. But with Roberts and with Scalia, I think kind of their argument, at least that which I've read, focused more on just the fact that it was such a you could kind of spot when gerrymandering had happened, but in terms of quantifying it, in terms of figuring out, you know, what is an egregious example versus a limited example, it was such a fluid concept that it was very difficult to put judges in an arbiter position where they would be writing it because they lacked the statistical and technological expertise to actually put a district together and then to put them in charge of it would potentially be difficult to figure out, you know, who is doing it too hard and too bad and all things like that. But it seemed to focus more on like the lack of a metric.
Yeah, so one thing that I say sometimes is that we should think about gerrymandering the way we think about black holes. And that's maybe a little bit of an odd analogy.
Go on.
But it's the same thing, right? We can't observe black holes. When we study black holes, we study the consequences that they have, right? We see the effect that their gravity has on stars around them and things like that. And that's how you find them. That's how you measure them. That's how you study them. And it's the same sort of thing with gerrymandering. We can talk about all the consequences of it. We can talk about how it changes the dynamics of elections, how it makes primaries more important, how it pushes parties to the left and right, the effect that it has on incumbency, whatever. But it's very difficult to actually define what is a gerrymandered district, right? There's not a clear line. And the court, dealing in issues of law and objectivity, wants that clear line. So that's kind of always been the problem. Now, there are, you know, we've got more advanced computers now. We've got ways to measure districts. We've got this thing called the efficiency gap that was at the center of that Wisconsin case that went to the Supreme Court last year.
Right. Yeah. Tell me about the efficiency gap. That was one of the wonky questions I had for you. We'll also, and like, yep, if you're seated, get ready, because I'm also going to ask about the Polsby popper system. But let's start with the efficiency gap.
The Polsby popper system is fun. That's a fun one to say, at least. The efficiency gap is essentially an attempt to make a mathematical calculation of how many wasted votes there are in a district. So what it tries to do is to say, let's say you've got a district that is packed, right? We talked about that earlier. If you've got a district that is packed with Democratic voters and it's 85% Democrats in that district, every vote that's cast above what is needed to get a candidate to 50% plus one, first past the post, that's how you win elections in America, right?
Yeah.
Every vote that's cast above that level is a quote-unquote wasted vote. And so the efficiency gap is then a sort of metric, a percentage based on the number of quote-unquote wasted votes versus, you know, over an entire state, over a series of elections.
Is this a proportional thing or is it a numbers thing? Because it's presumably 49% of all votes are wasted by the way you're describing it. So is it a question of like, well, this was a competitive election and therefore I think congressional districts are what, 711,000 people or so is what they're pegged to.
Yep.
So, 200,000 people showed up to vote as opposed to like a district that only has like 80,000 people. So is it a numbers game or is it the amount of the losing party that voted?
Yeah, no, it's a percentage. It's a percentage of the overall vote on a statewide basis, looking at all the districts within that state. So it presumes that every vote for a losing candidate is a quote-unquote wasted vote, and then every vote above and beyond that 50% plus one is also a wasted vote. What it's trying to do is it's trying to say it's trying to achieve a sort of balance where all races, all congressional races in the state are as close as possible, right? Like it's trying to create a system, a good system under the efficiency gap model would be one in which every district is really competitive between Democrats and Republicans. And
so I don't really follow this so far because it's not like every state comes with a prepackaged amount of Democrats and Republicans.
Right.
It varies. So like Oklahoma, where I'm from, where there now is a Democratic district, for the last 6 years was all Republican. And I would just, you know, when you look at the Senate elections, it goes Republican virtually every time, at least, you know, in the last 20 years. So how would you use that system on the presumption that that you've got a balance of partisans?
The argument that's made is that if you have, you know, let's take a state that, like Wisconsin, for example, which was the one that went to the Supreme Court using this sort of efficiency gap model as part of the argument. You have a state where you know how many Democrats and how many Republicans there are in that state, and you can figure out if there were, for example, a statewide proportional vote, you would know how close that race in theory would be, and then you compare that to the actual results in the actual districts that are drawn over a series
okay.
of elections.
So if we've got in a given election overall, we've got like 60% right. votes Democrat, 40% votes Republican. But if the proportion of delegates elected is wildly different from that proportion,
exactly.
then we could infer that the gap between it is that efficiency gap.
But it has some shortcomings, right? Because it fails to take into account. I mean, you could have a blowout election for any number of reasons that may not necessarily
yeah.
be directly tied to gerrymandering. So it has some shortcomings. It's an attempt to sort of put numbers to this problem
yeah.
of gerrymandering.
And I would also assume, because right now the largest voting block is independents, which are like at 40%. So that would be harder
and
to
you've
calculate.
Got a very swingy electorate right now, too, right?
Right?
Where people
yeah.
are voting. People voted for Obama and then turned around and voted for Trump 4 years later, which,
yeah.
which doesn't make a lot of sense from a like political science perspective, especially a very math side of political science like this model comes from. But that's the truth of the electorate is it doesn't always make sense. It doesn't always fit the models that we have.
Okay. So what is the Polsby-Popper system?
The Polsby-Popper system is sort of an entirely different thing. Just to sort of finish up on the efficiency gap model, that was a case that went to the Supreme Court last year. It was an attempt basically by gerrymandering activists to say, look here, we've actually got numbers. We've got this objective standard that the court has been looking for ever since 2004 when
right,
Justice
okay.
Scalia authored this sort of landmark decision saying, hey, it's an unanswerable problem is what Scalia called it because we don't have an objective system. The court looked at that. And Chief Justice John Roberts authored this unanimous opinion where the court more or less rejected that idea. But back to what you were saying a minute ago about the sort of two sides of the Supreme Court, that is part of this dynamic for sure, because even though it was a unanimous decision to toss the Wisconsin case last year, you did have the four liberal justices authoring a separate opinion from Roberts, a concurring opinion, so they agreed
okay,
with his
yeah.
decision. But they laid out
reasons,
sort
yeah.
of a different argument. Yeah, so there is sort of two perspectives on the court, but right now neither of them has been satisfied. So the Polsby-Popper system then is something a little bit different. The Polsby-Popper system is purely a mathematical analysis that looks at a district based on how compact it is. So a Polsby-Popper measurement of one is perfectly compact. That would be a perfectly round
There would be 711,000 people holding hands in a very large circle.
And all chanting together
okay.
in unison or something, right. But
so
yeah,
Whoville,
that would be
Whoville
one.
Is that?
That's Whoville would be, right, is exactly a one on the Polsby-Popper scale, I imagine. I don't know, maybe the Grinch gets in there and messes it up. And then from there you go down, so you basically what you're taking is you're taking the measurement of a district's, you're taking the area of the district and measuring it against the area of a circle whose circumference is equal to the district's perimeter. That's a lot of math, but basically if you have one of those long lightning-shaped districts, if you were to stretch it out so that it was a perfect circle that encompassed the whole district, and then you're measuring the actual district versus that perimeter, and you get a percentage. So, you get a number somewhere between 0 and 1, basically.
Okay. So this is sort of a metric to determine the warping and geographical bending of a district.
Yeah, that's right. There's a couple different ways to do this, too. There are a couple different models. Poulsby Popper is one. It's in some ways the most popular. It's certainly the most fun to say. There's a couple other different versions of this. There's like the Ryok scale is another one that measures. If you had a district and you had to draw a circle that fully encompassed the district, then what percentage of that circle would be the district versus what wouldn't be the district? Again, you get a percentage scale. These are better measurements, I think, regardless of which one you want to pick. These are better ways of measuring it rather than relying on electoral outcomes. There's a lot of shortcomings, as we talked about, with something like the efficiency gap, or something that looks purely at results.
In the Reason magazine piece you wrote a year or two ago, maybe last year, you had been in favor of basically outsourcing this to computers, which I want to hear about, but I also want to hear a lot of states, which I took to be, I reread your article and was very disheartened to find out that independent state commissions apparently are not a panacea for this. But what a lot of states have done in response to blatant gerrymandering is that they've kicked it to an independent panel where a group of citizens or something other than the state legislature will endeavor to make a fairer district map, which seemed to me to be a step in the right direction. And a lot of states have done that. Colorado, California, Utah, Missouri, Michigan, maybe some more. I don't know. But in your piece, you'd said that I think like the efficiency gap was like 77% on average when state legislatures do it, and it was like 75% when the independent commissions do it. So there might be some subterfuge going on. It might just they may not be very good at it. What are the problems with those commissions, and why would computer models be better?
Yeah, so the problem with these commissions sometimes is that they end up getting captured by the exact same political interests that already control the state legislature when the state legislature draws these districts, right? California, for example, had a citizens commission that redrew the districts out there this past cycle in 2011, and it was sort of a mess. They ended up pretty gerrymandered. They ended up with a lot of Democratic activists that infiltrated the citizens commission.
California, you're breaking my heart. California had done this electoral reform, and then they wound up just doing the exact same nonsense, only using non-legislatures.
The only people who care about this thing, by and large, are people who have a stake in it, right? So, I mean, you're always going to have some biases there.
Yeah.
I think, and we can talk about the computer model stuff in a second, but I think the important thing for people to take away is just that we should really experiment with this a lot, right? And this is why I think it's important for whatever you think the answer is for gerrymandering, and I'm open to a lot of different answers here. Whatever you think the answer is, it's really one that should be implemented at the state level, not something that I think should be imposed by the Supreme Court from the top down, because honestly, we don't know, right? Go back to the black hole analogy. We're not exactly sure what gerrymandering is, even, and we're really not sure how to actually fix it. We know the current system with having state lawmakers draw the districts is pretty flawed, and there's lots of problems there, and they're fairly obvious, but we don't really know what any changes to that system will do, whether they'll improve things or maybe give us a worse outcome that we can't predict. So honestly, you just have to play with it. You just have to experiment. The problem is that this is a process that only happens once every 10 years, right? So that experimentation, that trial and failure, trial and error process might take you 30 years. It might take three or four cycles before we start to hone in on what the right way to do this is or what the best way to do this is. I don't think there really is a right way.
And it would be one of those
things,
too, if a state came up. I mean, this is a good example of the laboratories of democracy, I think. And if a state came up with a good example, it does require a lot of energy from the electorate in other states to set their legislatures right. But the temptation is to go, the federal government should fix this because it's the principle. We've been using vice principles. But at the same time, aside from the constitutional remit that would be broken, you could really mess it up. And so it probably involves yelling at your state legislatures and chastising them for what is a blatantly anti-democratic process and trying to get them into the right spot.
Well, I think the right way to go about it is to just sort of set some limitations. And whether you have the legislature doing it or whether you have a commission doing it, these commissions are increasingly popular. You mentioned this earlier, but Colorado, Michigan, Missouri, and Utah all in November of this past year, they all passed new rules that transfers the redistricting authority from state lawmakers over to these commissions. All the commissions work in slightly different ways, but basically getting the authority out of the state legislature's hands, or at least taking some of it away, letting other people participate. I think that makes a lot of sense. to go back to the computer modeling issue, I think another thing that states could do, I don't have a lot of hope that they will do it, but I think one thing they could do is you could have lawmakers basically pass limitations for themselves, basically put up fences.
So you can be kind of corrupt, but you could only be so corrupt.
Right.
You can make it look like a rabbit. You can't make it look like a rabbit on a skateboard punching Donald Duck. You only get one rabbit per district.
Right, right. So you could use something like the Polsby-Popper scale or the Ryok scale, and you could say, look, a district that scores less than 0.25, 25% on the Polsby-Popper scale is illegal. That's out of bounds. Draw whatever funny shapes you want, but it has to meet this objective standard within, you know, this mathematical formula. Everybody understands that formula going in. Everybody knows the rules of the game, and then it's a little more fair, at least, even if both sides are still going to try and screw the other. It's a little bit more fair. There's some rules on the board.
Yeah, and that sounds like a good idea to me, just because it would be wonderful if everybody in elected office or these parallel independent citizens commissions would go, okay, you know, I am very much rooting for my team, but really the honorable thing for me to do here is to, you know, look at this objectively. Like that, it would be difficult to legislate that. It would be difficult to legislate the intentionality there, and then also to be able to spot the intentionality from an objective perspective. So I think setting limits there is probably a better system, and I think you're on to something.
And I think you're right, too, that, you know, it's always going to be both sides against the other, and it's always going to be the two big parties against all the rest of us.
I was about to say, those of us that are pretty firmly in the independent camp, I'm looking at this going, so two monsters are just boxing each other. And at the end, I get to show up at the very end of this process. My political interests are not being taken into account in the system.
Yeah, exactly. So, like in Colorado, for example, the two new commissions that they've created there, one to do the congressional districts and one to do the state legislative districts. The members of those, they have, you know, a certain number delegated that'll be members of the Republican Party, members of the Democratic Party to sit on these commissions, and then they have a group that are registered independents. But if you're a registered member of a third party, there's no room for you on the commission. So if you're a registered Libertarian or a registered Green or something like that, oh, sorry, we forgot to include you. We don't have any space for you. So that's, you know, that's always the way this game is
a whole other thing. Is there's Republican and Democrat leading independents. There's like, I don't know, proper independents. Yeah, that does sound like a thing. So would a computer program, would it just be factoring in one of these scales and that would be the main thing? Or is there a specific way it would be? Presumably the computer, if you had, you know, Democratic and Republican and independent code makers look at it and go, okay, there's nothing squirrely about this. Presumably it's just looking at some amount of you know, density to geography, and it's relying on one of these prior scales. Is that the idea?
Yeah, I think, I mean, so the idea that you could outsource this entirely to computers, first of all, I think that's pretty politically untenable, because I don't think politicians are ever going to fully give up their ability to control the process.
Yeah.
But I mean, in theory, you could do this. 538 did a fun thing last year, I think it was, maybe the year before, where they did exactly this. They had a series of computer models built that were based on, you know, here's the current districts in every state. Here's a way you could redraw the districts to favor Republicans or to favor Democrats. Here's a way you could redraw the districts to try and get them all as close to party balance as possible. And here's a way where we could just tell a computer to draw every district as compact as physically possible. So what you end up with is you just end up with a bunch of sort of lumpy ovals all over the state, which in some ways, sure, compactness is important, right? We want compact districts as opposed to these long stretched out lightning bolt or Donald Duck kicking Goofy kind of looking things. But like, compactness in and of itself shouldn't be the only objective you're looking for there. There is some art to this. You want to maintain, you know, communities together.
Yeah.
You want to maintain cities and their suburbs together in districts. So I think there's some, humans are going to have a role to play in this process. But the way computers could be included is you could have a computer spit out dozens of potential maps, and you could then work from those or work from among those. Again, it's about setting some rules for how the process works.
That makes sense.
And I think, again, experiment with those rules as much as you want, but you need some rules.
So before we go, what sparked today's podcast was the forthcoming Supreme Court cases that are coming up. Is there anything in particular to watch with those? Is there something novel about them? Or are they kind of generic aggrieved parties approaching the Supreme Court about unfair gerrymandering practices?
Yeah, so to talk about those, we have to talk again a little bit about what happened last year in front of the Supreme Court. There was that unanimous decision, unanimous opinion that Chief Justice John Roberts authored, where essentially he added on to that previous decision. He said sort of, you know, in addition to the fact that we don't have an objective workable standard, we're also, the Supreme Court is not going to be responsible for vindicating generalized partisan preferences. So his view is that the court is not going to get involved in this, you know, oh, Democrats saying, hey, Republicans drew these districts unfairly, or Republicans saying, hey, Democrats drew these districts unfairly. But he did sort of leave the door open to, and then the four liberal justices on the court, in their concurring opinion, really left the door open to a sort of different approach that would try to look at individual cases where voters had maybe been disenfranchised. And this builds on that longstanding tradition that the court has of getting involved in, like, racial gerrymandering. So the court, they didn't really, you know, make it too clear, but they sort of left a roadmap there for how you could maybe, how they would be interested in hearing a future case. So that's what you have this year. You have one of the challenges in front of the court this year is out of North Carolina. It has to do with one of the plaintiffs in the case, for example, is a Democratic activist. And she says that, look, the district has been the whole state has been unfairly gerrymandered so that Republicans win most of the seats no matter what. And that means that my political activism is no longer significant. Like, I've been robbed of my ability to do political activism.
Wait, hold on. So, in terms of my livelihood or the grievances that her impactfulness on a political, it's not the votes, it's not the election that she's worried about. It's just the extent of her political activity.
Yeah, that's right. Her name is Faulkner Fox.
I should file a lot of Supreme Court grievances because my own political activity has really been pretty stunted, in my opinion. And if I could foist that on the state legislatures, I'd love to.
This is generally my view of this challenge, too. And who knows how the court's going to view it. But I mean, I think her argument is primarily, and her argument is, again, this idea that these unfair congressional districts have made her activism almost irrelevant, is how she puts it. And so I think in some ways, you know, I think she's kind of right. North Carolina is basically a purple state, but Republicans have won 10 of the 13 congressional districts ever since the 2012 rewrite or redrawing of the map. But I think what ultimately this kind of comes down to being more like political sour grapes than anything else, right? It's a little bit unconvincing to me, because even if you could prove that it was gerrymandering that is, like, uniquely to blame for the loss of her ability to influence elections through her activism, I think, you know, any Republican in Washington, D.C. or in Philadelphia would have that same complaint. Any, you know, any libertarian or independent or third party member would have that same argument as well. And the Supreme Court isn't obviously going to step in into those other cases and say, oh, well, we have to have, you know, we have to draw districts that make the 10 Republicans in Philadelphia happy because they're disenfranchised. Like, that's, unfortunately, some of this is just built into the process, right? Like, just because your preferred candidate loses doesn't mean you get to go to the Supreme Court and ask them to change things for you.
Yeah.
So, again, I think this is just another great example of why this solution, she's making primarily a political argument. She's saying, look, these districts are unfairly drawn, and it affects me, and it affects other people like me who are political activists in North Carolina. And that's an argument that should be made in North Carolina to the lawmakers in Raleigh. You know, yeah, that's where the right place for that argument to be made. And it's an argument for making changes to the process. But I don't think it's an argument, at least it doesn't move me, to think that it's an argument that that would make the Supreme Court say, oh, yeah, now we know we have to draw some lines.
Well, plus, I would also say, just given the movement on state levels over the last 10 years, this is something that states are collectively working on. It's not,
sure,
if it were, this would not negate the constitutional restraints that we're operating under. However, if you were only looking at it from a consequentialist perspective, going, look, it sounds great in theory for states to do this, but they don't, there has to be a federal solution. This isn't one of those cases, because there are states that are stepping in and changing the way they do things. Whether they're doing it for good or for bad is yet to play out, or might well be bad. But right, it does seem to, there seems to be some amount of innovation going on there, which I take as a positive sign. I hate gerrymandering. It like, not just the effects of it. There's just something on a moral level that profoundly bothers me about this. And I would love it if states continue coming up with ways to alter this just blatant undemocratic redistricting and all of that.
And I think one of the great things about all the attention that has been on this issue for the last, you know, really the last 10 years, but especially the last few years, is now as we do go into the next cycle of this, we go to the 2020 census and we go into the next round of redistricting after that, even in states that haven't had any reforms, there's going to be more attention on this issue. It's not going to be something that lawmakers are going to get away with doing in a back room. I was in Harrisburg. I was covering the Pennsylvania state capitol when all this went down, when Tim Holton, you know, to bring us back around to the top of the conversation, when his
I got to pause this just in case anybody listening to the podcast isn't picking up on how encyclopedic Eric's knowledge is. That amazes me that I can bring up Tim Holton and you can not only know everything about that, but know the size of the cities in his old district. I'm very impressed.
I'm a Pennsylvanian. I wouldn't know the size of Reading if it wasn't
Well, never mind. Now I'm not impressed.
It's just the best state.
That's the motto.
I was there and we watched this all play out. Other reporters and I who were at the state capitol covering this stuff, and the lawmakers bring out the maps that they had drawn in back room. There were no hearings. There was no open discussion of this. They had a committee meeting. They said, okay, here's the maps. Let's talk about them for 5 minutes. Let's vote on them and send them to the governor. And that's kind of how the process plays out. You obviously know there's a lot happening behind the scenes, but it doesn't happen in public.
There's a lot of smoke-filled
but nobody really
rooms.
Cared. Yeah, but nobody really cared. There wasn't much outcry. There weren't a lot of people paying that much attention to the new congressional maps. I think that'll change this time around. I think these will be national stories. I think you'll have, there's sort of now a built-in audience for this type of issue. So I think you'll see more coverage of this.
And the spark that will change all of that is this episode of Something's Off with Andrew Heaton, which I'm very grateful you joined
me
for, Eric Boehm. Thank you very much. Continue doing your good work over at Reason, and please come back again.
Sounds good. Thanks so much, Andrew. Thanks for having me on.
All right, before I sign off for the day, I'm going to do a little bit of listener feedback, which I might literally rename Heaton Answers Questions About Star Trek, because that probably constitutes half of the feedback I get, at least in email form. But before we get into that, Carl writes, often on the podcast, you speak about moderation and that most people don't actually fall into an extreme portrayal of any particular ideology. The majority of Americans being centrist or simply independent with nuanced platforms that cannot be summarized by a single party or even ideology. Personally, I agree, but would also point that this indicates perhaps the majority of people are uninterested in taking a hard position against government overreach unless it directly affects something they care about. In an example you spoke about with Gene Epstein, you personally like the things NASA does, which, by the way, Gene will not let me forget. I saw him in New York, and we had three conversations about this. It is the first thing he brings up when he sees me. I like things NASA. Therefore, this is back to Carl. Therefore, we'll create a rationale for redistributing wealth to space projects. Yes, I probably would. Is it possible that centrism has led to complacency in our political system? I think it's a great point you bring up. I'd like to clarify two terms, and these are my terms. I think in a broader context they're interchangeable. So there's no lexicon that's central to them. But for my purposes, when I'm talking, I would make a distinction between centrism and moderation. Centrism is basically a descriptive word establishing where someone falls along a political spectrum, and in fact they're averaging out two positions. Whereas moderation, I would say, is a temperamental description. So centrism, I don't think there's any benefit to it ideologically, because if you're attempting to be a centrist, if you're making it prescriptive rather than descriptive, you're just trying to find the most palatable solution between two different extremes, and a lot of the time that really just won't work. If you're slavery, that sounds bad, but I want to hear the other argument on this, and I'm willing to meet you halfway. So maybe you'll only own people for 10 years. It's terrible, right? Or we could get into minimum wage. I think minimum wage is a bad idea. I've covered that on previous podcasts. The centrist position would be, let's raise it a little bit, and I don't know that is really a useful thing. Moderation, I would define temperamentally. So I would describe a moderate, in my ideology, or in my terms, as someone who is probably more inclined towards a pragmatic solution than one that is ideological resonant. So I'm gonna get half of what I want instead of nothing of what I want, while maintaining an ideological purity. A moderate's probably going to be open to the possibility that they're wrong in terms of temperament, and a moderate's going to be okay with interacting with someone they disagree with without thinking that they're evil. Now, where this would go into your question, Carl, I do think you're right. A moderate is therefore, if they're going to go into a situation with the premise that they could be wrong and that the person they're talking to is not evil, they're far more likely to strike a deal and come up with a bipartisan solution. And it would be nice to think that bipartisanship goes all across the board in terms of cutting government fat. It very rarely does. Most of the time, bipartisanship results in greater spending, where both parties hold hands and agree to spend money on two projects simultaneously instead of just on one. So I think your point is well met, that centrism or moderation, everyone want to define it, might kind of loom, slide into that. That said, though, I think that's part of the struggle for those of us that are you know, tiny government, boutique government fans, and at the same time, very emphatic about social capital and civility and open-mindedness and critical thinking, and having to police ourselves in terms of that, of not just washing out in the effort to not be combative, but maintaining that those values, but at the same time also implementing them in a civil way. Ryan Wieland writes, so would there be Citizens Underwater Bank in the Star Trek universe? That is a great question. I think potentially. So the Star Trek universe, not socialist. It's post-scarcity. There is a difference because there's free and abundant energy, and there's also replicators. You can get any material good you want in the Star Trek universe, right? You could have any number of suits. You could have, that's where my mind went. You could have any amount of food that you want. You could, presumably, they probably have 3D printing or something. You could build your house. Where I think you would still maintain a currency in the Star Trek universe is in goods which are indivisible. So, for example, if I want to go eat at Ben Sisko's dad's restaurant, there's only so many people that can go in there, even if he doesn't have a salary, because no one has a salary, there's no currency. There's still some sort of ration system for getting into a really good restaurant. Or if you want to buy Picard Vineyards wine, I can get wine itself from the replicator with synthol in it. But if I want Picard Vineyards explicitly, where there is a specific limited amount of an emotionally significant item, then there might be some kind of credit system in place where I'm gonna go on Etsy and I'm going to make a certain amount of fan art from Battlestar Galactica, and I will trade 5 of my Saltai doilies that I made, and in exchange you have to give me 1 bottle of wine. I think something like that could exist, right? So in that world, there could be a Citizens Underwater Bank that deals with these emotional credit units or sentimental credit units or whatever you want to call it. So, yes. Thank you. Great question. Remember, you can always tweet me at Mighty Heaton or Facebook me at facebook.com/Mighty Heaton, or even email me by subscribing to my newsletter at MightyHeaton.com and just replying when I send out the newsletter on Fridays. And I encourage you to do so. I like hearing from you guys. This is a fun experience for me, finding out what you enjoy, which I'm almost always pleasantly surprised by. And also, I appreciate suggestions on things you want to hear about, because there's a lot of content to go through, and I'm happy to get that input. I'd also like to encourage you to subscribe to Blaze TV and download the Blaze TV app. If you do, you can watch me instead of just listening to me. Use the promo code Heaton to get $10 off your annual Blaze TV subscription. I look like a younger Hugh Grant with a beard from Oklahoma. That's me. You could see that if you went on that. So download Blaze TV app on iTunes or Google Play. Get subscribed to The Blaze and then fall in love with me more than you already are. You can also watch portions of the show on Facebook Watch by going to facebook.com/HeatonTV. Finally, please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. That helps other people discover this here political orphanage and fight gerrymandering. Good day.